Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies that operates online through the New Books Network. In this podcast, we talk to authors of exciting and important new books in the broader field of Islamic studies. In the last few decades, questions relating to Islam's compatibility with liberal secular democracy, or the question of why Islam remains incompatible with Western liberal norms of thought and politics, have generated considerable commentary in both scholarly and journalistic communities. Among the central assumptions driving such compatibility talk relates to Islam's allegedly inherent incapacity for critique, a virtue often heralded as a signature achievement and characteristic of liberal secularism. Irfan Ahmed's new book, Religion as Critique, Islamic Critical Thinking from Mecca to the Marketplace, represents a devastating indictment of this dominant liberal assumption that Islam is inimical to critique. Turning this assumption on its head, Ahmed combines historical, textual, and ethnographic methods to argue that critique is and has always been central to Muslim intellectual thought and lived practice. The distinctive feature of this book is the way it fluctuates the canon of analysis between a genealogy of Western liberal discourses of critique as a way to puncture their universality and inevitability, while bringing into view alternate logics and imaginaries of critique in Muslim thought and practice, past and present. Eminently readable, this book will be widely discussed and debated in multiple fields, including religious studies and Islamic studies. Here now is my conversation with Professor Irfan Ahmed. Hello, Irfan. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Wonderful. Irfan, thank you so much for your time and for this really incredible book that talks to multiple fields, including South Asian Islam, Islamic studies, more broadly speaking, and to critical thought, more generally speaking. So thank you so much for this book. We have a tradition on new books in Islamic studies, and our first question is always biographical. Irfan, could you share a bit with our listeners how you became a scholar of Islam and Muslim societies? Could you share a bit with us about your intellectual journey?
Oh, intellectual journey. Okay, this is a relevant question, but perhaps too early to account for it. But let me try to answer your question. I was born in a small village of Bihar in North India, where there was no electricity, no metal road, no proper government school. And it was, by and large, a peasant society. So in addition to being an auditor in a bank, my father was a farmer. So much of our life as a child revolved around land, farming, rice, wheat, flood, and so on. So I went to a madrasa in my own village, and I studied until class 6 in that madrasa. It was later on that I moved to Patna, which was the capital of Bihar. So I did my intermediate studies there, and then for bachelor's and MPhil, I moved to Delhi, and I did my study at Jamia Millia Islamia and Jawaharlal Nehru University. So at JNU, where I did my MPhil, actually I was interested in the issues of peasantry. In fact, I remember taking a course which was called Peasant Sociology, and I wrote a paper about peasants and Bihar. That time, the question that I had was why in North Bihar, where I came from, there is no peasant movement, whereas in Central Bihar, there was a strong peasant movement. Now, while I was interested in this question of peasants in a rural setting, I came to study some issues like, you know, the Permanent Settlement Act of India, which was, you know, introduced in by the British government in 1793. And then it occurred to me the question of peasantry or the economic question is also related to religion. So, for example, 1793 Permanent Settlement Act, it was not simply an economic issue, it was equally a religious one. As you know, it led to the creation of new zamindars who were mostly Hindus, and the peasantry was mostly Muslims. So, likewise, you know, the question of Urdu, it was often viewed as a linguistic question or a question of religion, namely that Urdu was equated with Muslims and Hindi with Hindus. And of course, it was wrong, but it appeared to me that it was no less an economic question. For example, in post-independence India, what would the Urdu speakers do? Will they get a job or not? So at that time, I have not formulated it clearly, but I was dissatisfied with this neat classification of something called economy separate from religion or politics and vice versa. Now, the time in which I did my master's and MPhil, this was the time of mid-90s and late 90s. And there were also political issues of Islam's alleged intolerance to other religions and Hinduism's so-called innate tolerance. This was the time of, if you recall, Hindutva movement, which, illegally demolished Babri Masjid. And there were also issues of Islamophobia as manifest at that time in the novel of Lajja by Taslima Nasreen. This, of course, was prefaced by Salman Rushdie's Saronic Verses. And connect that national Indian scene with international relations where people like Huntington had made Islam as the new enemy of the New World Order. And Huntington's thesis, to note, did not emerge out of the blue. It was a reflection of century-old Western scholarship, which in some ways was also institutionalized in academic disciplines and various other domain of knowledge. So across the board, not only in the media discourses, but also in mainstream academic discourses, Islam was depicted as hostile to critique, peace, pluralism. Muslims were perceived not to have an intellectual capacity to debate and discussion, and that they have a tradition of critique of their own was almost unthinkable. So such views went against what I had learned at madrasa, what my elders and family members had taught us. My father actually taught us to be very critical. He read Ghalib, Iqbal, Jamil Mazhari. He also had a few books in English. So while doing my fieldwork for my first book on Jamaat-e-Islami, I met many people who were critical of Maududi. There were critiques within Jamaat as well. And yes, Maududi himself was no less critical. So what I found during my fieldwork and what I experienced as an individual, however, did not have any voice in much of the academic literature. It was almost absent, unrecognized. In fact, the idea of critique within Islam was an unthought. So the project of the book is as much about Islam and Muslim society as it is a general scholarly pursuit, a pursuit about what is unthought, underthought, and overthought. And not just about Muslims, but about the entangled lives of people of many faiths, or perhaps no faith. So This probably is a little bit long response, but this is how I see my journey.
Terrific. Wonderful. Irfan, you've already begun to talk a bit about the central themes of this book as part of this intellectual journey that you just beautifully outlined for us. But perhaps you could say a bit more. I mean, the title of this book is Religion as Critique, Islamic Critical Thinking from Mecca to the Marketplace, which is a very interesting and intriguing title. And when someone reads this book, of course, they understand what you're after here. But could you share with our listeners a bit how this title sort of captures the central argument that you pursue in this project, building on what you were already saying in response to the last question?
Sure. So it occurred to me, like, you know, unlike most books on Islam, which accepts the terms and axioms of social sciences and then proceed to write about Islam, what Religion as Critique does is to first examine the larger premise of social science and then investigate the subject of Islam and Muslim tradition. Put differently, it is my contention that a thorough study of Islam must also integrate the very conceptual and academic space in which the study of Islam has been placed and pigeonholed, rather, as a distinct field. That is to say, a study of Islam should also say something about the study of religion in general. So, to be sure, the book deals with Islam and Muslim cultures. However, there is a much larger premise, namely, critique is part of other religious traditions too. So, if you recall, in the book, I discuss how Gautam Buddha was a critic, how Buddha critiqued Brahmanism of his own time, and how he mounted a critique of ritualized hierarchy. Of course, in Islamic tradition, prophets in general have been viewed as reformer, their task being the reform of society. Thus, Moses, Christ, Muhammad are critiques from the perspective of this book. So these examples are more from the past. To take a more contemporary example, Tony Abbott was the Prime Minister of Australia, and as you may know, I taught in Amsterdam in Australian universities for 9 years. Tony Abbott was a deeply religious person. He's a Christian. In a televised show, an audience asked him, and let me recall what was the question. It was something like this: when it comes to asylum seekers, what would Jesus do? And then Tony Abbott's reply was very curious. He said, and this again went something like this. He said, Jesus was the best man who ever lived, but that doesn't mean that Jesus said yes to everyone, meaning those who want to come to Australia. Now, Abbott's reply showed how he read Jesus and his life to justify ethnic policy of the Australian state. In a way, it was similar to Christians using the Bible to justify conquest and racism. But we also know that Christians use the Bible to contest slavery. Likewise, many Christians critiqued Abbott for misusing Jesus. In many ways, Gandhi also critiqued Hinduism through Hinduism. However, in my view, like Abbott's, Gandhi's critique was ultimately at the service of the nation state. In contrast, critique by Muslim also showed the limits and the dark underbelly of nation state. So to return to your question, the title makes a general claim about religion and critique. The subtitle illustrates that general claim by focusing on Islam. And in so doing, it combines insights from anthropology, philosophy, studies of religion, and other disciplines. And it shows how the ideas and practices of critique, historically as well as contemporaneously, have worked in Islamic tradition.
One of the most, the biggest strengths of this book, as you mentioned, was that it is not only about Islam, but also about the conceptual space in which the study of Islam takes place. And one of the central arguments that you make in the book has to do with the Enlightenment. And you make the argument that the Enlightenment was a local ethnic project, whereby its forms of reason and critique have been assumed to be universal, but in fact, it was a process of positing and pitting a series of others, including Islam. So could you share with our listeners some key aspects of this argument, how you puncture the universality of the Enlightenment as the universal form of reason and critique. Could you say a bit about this aspect of the argument?
That is a great question, and thanks for asking it. The way I will respond to this is as follows. You see, the doxa or the common sense has it that the Western Enlightenment was a landmark in human history. And normatively speaking, it was also regarded as a wonderful achievement because it is believed that it inaugurated rationality, freedom, tolerance, democracy, secularity, and what have you. And also the assumption that it was universal. So if you see, then enlightenment is not simply an idea, it is also an idea. That is, society and cultures which did not have it must also have it to qualify as a candidate to be accepted in the global hierarchy of cultures. So this usual linear story goes something like this, that first there was Renaissance, which led to Reformation, and then the Reformation led to Enlightenment. But the question is it really the case? I have not seen any study that convincingly shows how logically and causatively the Renaissance led to Reformation and Reformation led to Enlightenment. So at best, it seems to me it is a story told again and again. Now, the method through which I reached my argument about the Enlightenment as ethnic project is very much Nietzschean and Talal Asadian. I begin with the present and trace its linkages and connection back to the past, and in this case, to the 18th century. So if we begin with the present, two events in 20th century and 21st century are crucial. One is, of course, the War on Terror. And this was justified in many writings by invoking the Enlightenment. And you had native informants like Salman Rushdie or Farid Zakaria, who spoke about the need for Islam's reformation, Enlightenment, or liberalism. You could also think of Christopher Hitchens, though in a different way. Now, before the War on Terror, of course, there was the Cold War. And American scholars like, you know, Edward Shields, they mobilized the Enlightenment as ethnic marker of the so-called free world against its then enemy, namely communism and the USSR. So what we see here is the following. In both War on Terror and the Cold War, the Enlightenment was mobilized inimically to set friends apart from the enemy. And this, in my reading, was also the case in 18th century and with Immanuel Kant, who is regarded as the star philosopher of the Enlightenment. Now, of course, Kant's philosophy is very complex, but for our purpose here, he is credited with inaugurating a Copernican revolution in Western philosophy. And central to this very act of philosophizing was to secure a firm ground. And in Kant, his project was to bring philosophy on a secure foundation. So the foundation cannot be marshy or shaky, it has to be firm. Now, if we take Kant as an example of the Enlightenment, which many scholars would have agreement about, so what you see in the first edition of Critique of Pure Reason, Kant outlined a challenge to a rebuilding of metaphysics from those who he described as nomads. And the figure of nomad is important here because in Kant's view, nomads, they hate all kinds of permanent residence or what he called cultivation of the soil. Okay? Now, in the second edition, this nomadism is fought by drawing a proper boundary within which philosophy can thrive and it can contest uncertainty. Now, the figure of nomadism in Kant is basically the Arabs and the Mongols, who, according to Kant, they nurture contempt for the town dwellers or the permanent residents. Now, that is to say the Arabs become signifier of the nomad and the other of permanent residence. Along with these nomads, the danger to philosophy for Kant came from what he called enthusiasm, zeal, fanaticism, and sensuality. And Kant described Muhammad as a zealot. And this is a quote from him, that zeal leads the zealot to the external, led Muhammad onto his princely throne. So in Critique of Practical Reason, the figure of Muhammad again comes as a sign of unreason, nonsense, dream, or madness of imagination. So if Islam is anything for Kant, it is the triumph of revelation over reason. He even described Islam as opiate, reason-ridden, sense-dominated, and non-rational creed. So this is more the conceptual aspect of Kantian enlightenment. Now, among the philosophers, there is some dispute as to what extent his later work, which is called Anthropology from a Pragmatic Viewpoint, how important it is. Generally, philosophers don't consider it important, but in my view, it is important, not simply because I'm an anthropologist. But this is a book where the figure of Muslim is very prominent. I mean, this is a book in which Kant describes the so-called characteristics of different peoples or nations. And as many have noted, it is filled with racism of all sorts. Now, when it comes to Islam, in this book, at one place, Kant contrasts, for example, the good side with the worst side of the Spaniards, for example. And he explains the worst side of Spaniards in terms of having a non-European origin. Now, what is that non-European origin? And he himself explains, because the Spaniards are from the mixture of European with the Arabian / Moorish blood. In other words, Muslim blood in the Spaniards is responsible for their worst side. Now, part of this book deals with, as I said, description of different nationalities and nations. Turks are excluded from the description because, according to Kant, Turks never will attain what is necessary for the acquisition of a definite national character. So it is precisely in this sense that I argue that Kant and his enlightenment was ethnic. Now, I just want to quickly say a few words about the French Enlightenment, because it is widely believed that French Enlightenment was more militantly against religion than the German one. And as you know, in the French Enlightenment, the French philosophers, they directly attacked Islam. You know, even though you do not have Muslims as a collectivity living in France. Now, the justification of this move is given as follows, that actually the French philosophers, they were not interested in Islam per se, but they did attack it. But what they did was basically to attack Christianity, but because of the censorship, they could not have attacked Christianity, therefore they attacked Islam, you know, to avoid censorship. Now, I think, to me, then the question would be, if that is the premise to go by institutionally, was the problem of 18th century Christianity similar to Islam? Or is the assumption that Islam is not a religion, but the religion, and therefore a critique of Islam is also a critique of religion at large? Or are Islam and Christianity substitutes, implying no difference between the two? Moreover, can the specificity of Christianity be translated into a generality, which in turn is typified similarly in Islam? But also note that, you know, Voltaire, who is regarded as the key figure of French Enlightenment, contrary to the common view, Voltaire was not opposed to religion in itself. Indeed, he was an enemy of atheism, and Voltaire was a believer. He believed in true Christianity. In critiquing the church, clergy, and orthodoxy, Voltaire's reference point was not reason stripped from tradition and religion. It was actually what he called the opposite of the religion of Jesus. So what you see here, both in the German and French Enlightenment, Christianity was not demolished. It was rather reconfigured. And in this reconfiguration, Islam was mobilized to serve as the other of Europe and reason. And therefore, I describe in the book Enlightenment as an ethnic project.
Terrific. Thank you so much for that excellent and thorough answer, Irfan. So let's move to the second part of the title, I guess, of Islamic critical thinking. And I wanted to ask you specifically about the alternative intellectual resources and traditions of critique that you mine and that you explore, especially from the South Asian Muslim intellectual traditions, by looking at categories of critique from Urdu, etc. Could you share with our listeners a bit about these alternative resources from the South Asian Muslim intellectual tradition?
Yeah, sure. I think the one way to address this question is also to bring to listeners one of the key premise of the Western thinking about it. As you know, the German-American philosopher Leo Strauss, he famously described Western philosophy as a tension between Athens and Jerusalem, meaning ancient Greece and the environment in which Christianity was born. Now, this yoking of Greece and Christianity together, historians have described it as a very recent phenomenon going back to late 18th century, especially if you see the work of this great work by Martin Buber. Now, since all contemporary debates in social sciences and humanities more or less begin with modernity or the Enlightenment, it occurred to me that an alternative ought to precede the Enlightenment. And it is for this reason that I bring the Axial Age, which historians dated somewhere between 800 to 200 BC, and discuss in this context works of various scholars like Robert Ballagh, Carl Jaspers, and so on. So situating Islam in the frame of the reformulated Axial Age helps us move beyond both modernity and ancient Greece. So if prophets like Moses, Jesus, and Muhammad are critiques, as I argue, then our point of beginning are neither Europe nor Greece, and obviously not the Enlightenment. So the alternative that emerges from the examination of Islamic tradition in South Asia, in the book I describe it at length, but I think for the listeners, let me try to compress it in three terms. So the first one is, unlike the tension between Athens and Jerusalem that Leo Strauss spoke about in Western philosophy, in the Hejaz, which is the area combining Mecca and Medina, and Islamic tradition at large, there is no tension as such. What emerges is actually an anti-dualism. Muhammad's enterprise was not based on dualism between faith and reason or mind and heart. Instead, in Islamic tradition, they cohere together. So you see a simultaneity and coexistence of heart, reason, and mind. And in among the ulama, as well as among the common people, you see the coexistence of heart and mind, you know, qalb, dil on the one hand and dimag on the other. So instead of both, you know, in Arabic and Urdu, instead of splitting them apart, the term qalb actually encapsulates intellect and feelings. The second thing which emerges from the examination of this Islamic tradition is that, unlike the Enlightenment notion of critique as a right, Muslims view critique as a practice seen in terms of duty, as a fard. So I'm not, positing as right and duty as opposite of each other, but of course there is a significant difference in terms of emphasis. The third point of difference is that there is so much of emphasis in the Western Enlightenment tradition of critique on tongue, on saying, and there is less on listening. But it also is related to the fact that in Islamic tradition, actually the intellect or the reason is not an independent entity in its own right, but it is something which is related to the qalb or the heart. And the locus of reason and intellect is qalb. So that you see the difference, like, you know, one of the examples that I give is, if you look at the prefaces or the introduction of books written in English, but in the West, you always appeal to readers' judgment and reasoning. Whereas in Persian and Urdu tradition, authors would appeal to the heart and the reason of their readers at the same time.
So let us now shift to one of the central protagonists of this book, Abul Ala Maududi. And you spend a lot of time thinking about Maududi as a political thinker and as a political critic. I know this is a big question, so again I will ask you to sort of choose some examples from an analysis of how does critique operate in Maududi's thought and writings, in his political thought and writings, and how does your analysis of his thought complicate the way we usually understand and approach Islamism as a category?
Yeah, so this is a very profound question. But let me start by saying that even though I myself have used this term called Islamism, but of course it is a problematic term, you know. So let's see, Christians who make Christianity important to their politics are called Christian Democrats. And in Europe you have, you know, Christian Democratic parties who have been central, for example, to the politics of Germany, Italy and the Netherlands. But they are simply called Christian Democrats. So the term is positive. Likewise, Hindus who make Hinduism central to their politics are called Hindu nationalists, you know. And that term is, of course, you know, positive. Sometimes it is even more dignified, actually. In contrast, the term Islamism and Islamist rarely have a positive signification, you know. So discussing this way means accepting terminological asymmetry, you know. Now, with this qualification, I think what I do in religion as critique is to refuse the description of Maududi as a fundamentalist or Islamist, which is the most popular kind of description. And I instead, you know, put forward this idea that he should be viewed first and foremost as a political theorist. And I think to continue to call him a fundamentalist is, in my view, is an exercise in intellectual laziness. So if intellectual discussion and discourse on issues such as sovereignty, democracy, the state, pluralism, religion, and so on are the stuff that belongs to the realm of political theory, then Maududi is surely one. Now, when you see Maududi from this angle, what emerges is that he is at once wedded to and critical of religious tradition and practices he inherited, in the same way as he is receptive to and critical of modern developments and ideas like democracy, the state, and what have you. So my argument is that Maududi is critical not because of European influence, which is not to say that he was not influenced. Of course he was. So he's critical not because of European influence, but because of his immersion into Islamic thoughts and practices. And the same, of course, goes for his critiques, you know, which I deal with, and they include people from a wide variety of locations, including some of his former followers, those who are not from the Jamaat Islami, but from outside, you know. But my attempt is to situate that multiple critique within Islamic notion of critique and Islam.
So let us now shift the attention, as you mentioned earlier, also in response to this question, that Maududi also had his own critics or people who were critical of his thought also. So could you share with us a bit about how other scholars, especially other Muslim traditional scholars, the ulama, went about critiquing his, for example, conception of the state and so on? Could you share with us a bit about the people who were critical of Maududi as part of your analysis of traditions of critique in South Asian Islam?
Yeah, sure. So this is a little bit difficult question. So let me try to sort of, you know, set it in a frame. I mean, the earliest critique of Maududi came from Deoband or the ulama of Deoband. Of course, ulama of Deoband are described as traditionalist, but we have to be careful about using this term as well, because let's be clear that, you know, the sense in which we use tradition now is itself decisively modern. There was no term like tradition in the so-called pre-modern or traditional era of society. You see, so tradition itself is in some way enmeshed in the history of modernity. Now, one key critique from the traditionalist, and we use it the term with some reservation, was that Maududi was intensely preoccupied with the business of the state. And the critique from the traditionalist was that he presented Islam in such a way that a state became the pivot of Islam in general. And related to this, the traditional ulama, they critiqued Islam for neglecting the aspect of his spirituality or ruhaniyat, you know. So these were, I think, two important critiques leveled by the traditionalist. And I see that there is some merit in this critique, no doubt. However, if you dig a little deeper, it becomes apparent that the question is, or the critique is more in terms of emphasis or a stress. So it is not that a spirituality was entirely absent from Maududi or his followers in the same way as the state was of no concern to the traditionalist. You know, no community or group can be oblivious of the state in contemporary times precisely because of the modern state impacts every domain of life. Yet, not all groups are equally concerned with the critique of or being part of the state. And this, in my view, has to also do with the nature of the state itself and if it allows for political expression of certain kinds or not.
Now, as you mentioned earlier, that there are critics of Maududi within the Jamaat also, and you explore some of those vectors of critique, and especially you focus on this very fascinating topic of the critique of Maududi's conception of gender and gender roles, and you show that some of these critiques emerging from within the Jamaat can be useful ways of thinking about possibilities of female empowerment from within the tradition, rather than from a Western liberal conception of female empowerment and agency. So could you share with us a bit about this analysis that you conduct in your book about critiques of Maududi's conception of gender and gender roles, and what kinds of critique were these and how you conceptualize them?
Sure. Let me preface this answer by saying that on the issues of gender equality, like many modern philosophers such as Kant, Maududi's exposition on women question was heavily patriarchal. You know, you might recall this wonderful book by Genevieve Lloyd. It was called The Man of Reason, Male and Female in Western Philosophy. and why it shows the patriarchal nature of philosophy itself. So on many issues, Maududi simply used theology to endorse the societal prejudice of his own time. So in his view, to take one example, women could vote in election, but they themselves could not become prominent office bearers, for example, head of the state or prime minister. Now, even though Maududi had this general exposition, so we have to also see Maududi in at least two ways, that as a thinker or as a writer, but at the same time, he's also an activist. So when he began to participate in election, and in early 1960s, you had this issue of Fatima Jinnah, who contested election for Pakistan's presidency. So on that occasion, Maududi justified this, saying that a woman could become prime minister, okay? But he justified it on the doctrine of what is called darura, or necessity. So Maududi had to actually travel or find a line between at least two opposing perspectives. On the one hand, he had people like Amin Ahsan Islahi, who was earlier a comrade of Maududi. But when he gave this new argument that, you know, as a Muslim, we could vote for a woman to become prime minister, and woman could also become the head of the state, people like Amin Ahsan Islahi, they accused him of being a modernist or westernized intellectual, and also that they have compromised with the basics of Islam itself. On the other hand, of course, you had people like what was known as modernist, and Maududi had to grapple with their argument. And these modernists, at least in theory, they believed in gender equality. Now, critique of Maududi, which emerged from within, it emerges from a very different reading of Islam, and some of these readings are done by, or at least in the book, the ones that I focus on, these are male members of Jamaat-e-Islami, and they think that Maududi's own framework on this issue was more ethnic rather than universalist, because their idea is that if Maududi had taken a universalistic framework, then God would not make a distinction between men and women. Of course, there are biological differences, but that biological differences are not the ground for enforcing unequal law or depriving women of rights which are given to men. So their point was that the difference, or at least from a Quranic perspective, they would say that the difference between men and women is based on the degree of piety or taqwa, not because you are men and women. So in the eyes of God, the distinction would be made based on taqwa, not whether you are male or female. So this was one of the key arguments that the critics within Jamaat leveled against Maududi's patriarchal notion of what women, what kind of place women have in the society. But let me also quickly say here that a lot of these changes or the critique emerged in a context where actually practices were already ahead of theorization. So what I mean by this, the societal landscape had significantly changed, you know. So as of now, if you think about Pakistan, for example, the daughter of former Amir of Jamaat-e-Islam in Pakistan, she is a member of National Assembly. Now, that might be clearly against what Maududi had said, you know. So you see practices themselves become the ground for such kind of transformation and in the work of critique on the issue of the gender.
Now, one of the major strengths of this book is that it not only focuses on intellectual thought and textual corpus and writings, but it also talks about forms of critique in everyday life or in sort of non-textual registers. And to do that, you especially look at this very fascinating figure and movement that I will have you introduce to our listeners in a moment. So could you share with us this figure that you mentioned and talk about extensively towards the end of your book, Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan and Khudai Khidmatgar movement? Could you describe to us who was Ghaffar Khan and what was this Khudai Khidmatgar movement for our listeners who may not be familiar? And then share with us a bit about what modes of critical thought do we find in this movement that you analyze?
Thank you for this question. As you rightly noted, much of the discussion about critique, somehow it always begins with the assumption that, you know, critique is the domain of the intellectuals or the philosophers. And my sub-argument was that it is not simply the domain of philosophers and intellectuals or degree holders, but how non-educated or less educated or even uneducated person is engaged in this exercise of critique. And the focus on Ghaffar Khan enabled me to do this. And this is important to note because, as you know, unlike Sir Sayyid Ahmad Khan or Muhammad Iqbal or Abul Kalam Azad or Hussain Ahmad Madni, Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan is not known as an alim or as a scholar, right? So who was he? I mean, he was a person who was born in 1890. He lived for a long time. He died in 1988. But much of his activism was during the interwar period. And he came from what was called then as Northwest Frontier Province, which is a tribal area. So he was educated, but not in the sense of established a scholar. So what struck him was the kind of tribal society that he lived in. He saw a lot of practices in his own society, which according to him were not just practices. So even though he was not very well educated, he had studied Islam, and he was very much inspired by the message of the Quran and aspects of Prophet Muhammad's life. So there were two crucial things. The movement which he launched, and of course, it was the time of the colonial British rule. So one of his key concerns was how to get freedom for people of India at large, but in particular about his own community, which is called as Pashtun community or Pakhtun community. So in order to fight against the British, he thought that the use of violence is not what Islamic teaching has. So his main focus was that the fight against the British has to be non-violent. And he launched this movement, which was spectacular. Like thousands and thousands of people became member. Even when the British repressed this movement, and that is reflected in the famous or infamous Qissa Khani Bazar massacres, where according to the official figures, at least more than 100 people were killed. So even when the shots were being fired, people simply said Allahu Akbar, or they, you know, held a copy of Quran to their bosom, but they did not retaliate. So Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan's idea was that Islam teaches nonviolence, and the way he saw this movement was that the idea of sabr, and sabr generally translated, it might mean patience, but that actually is not the correct meaning. More appropriate meaning would be fortitude. So the idea of sabr is that you have to fight in the path of justice guided by a faith in a transcendental being, and you have to persevere in your fight. You don't give it up, even though you have problems and tribulations. So what we had in the form of this movement, which was called Khudai Khidmatgar, which in English might be described as God's servant. So this movement was at that time, especially in a very tribal society where the rate of literacy was probably not more than 3 or 4%. So bulk of the movement was it comprised of uneducated people. So my whole point in this chapter is how we can think about Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan and his movement, most of whose followers were uneducated peasants and illiterate, how they, through their activism, actually presented a critique of the British colonial order, but at the same time, a lot of practices which were rampant in that society. So Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan, as you know, he was also, for example, he sent his daughter to a study at Allahabad University. Now, in late 1920s and early 1930s, for a society like Northwest Frontier Province, for a woman to get a university education was considered something not acceptable. So this entire movement in for the freedom of India, as well as deployment of sabr and use of Islam as a source of inspiration. So my point was to show that critique is not simply an undertaking taken by the educated and the salaried philosophers, but how commoners like Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan and his followers also undertake critique. And it is not simply a textual thing. It is also a practice embodied in social movement.
So Irfan, as we're coming to the end of our time, could you share with us a bit what you're planning as your next project?
I mean, currently I'm working on two books. One is on democracy, and the other one is on terrorism. The one on democracy and election, it is focused on 2014 elections in India. And the other one on terrorism. So as you know, in the past 15 years or so, terrorism has been projected as the enemy of democracy. Now, through these two projects, I aim to examine to what extent that is the case, you know? And the question that I pose is very James Baldwin type. So, as you know, James Baldwin was not so much interested in the question of who is the Negro, but who needs the category of Negro. So likewise, I'm asking in this book on terrorism, not what is terrorism or who is a terrorist, but who needs the category of terrorism or the terrorist.
Religion as a critique, Islamic critical thinking from Mecca to the marketplace by Professor Irfan Ahmed, published by the University of North Carolina Press in 2017. Thank you so much, Irfan, for your time, for coming to New Books in Islamic Studies, and for sharing all your insights and your analysis from this book. I'm sure our listeners really would have benefited from your erudite answers and analysis. And so much, thank you so much for this book also. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having it. It was lovely talking to you.
So this was my conversation with Professor Irfan Ahmed on his new book, Religion as Critique, Islamic Critical Thinking from Mecca to the Marketplace. Thank you so much for listening. And please also join us next time for another new and fresh episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies, that operates online through the New Books Network. This is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Until next time, take care, stay well, and keep listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.